This is Bill Brenner for SearchSecurity.com. You're listening to our monthly Newsmaker podcast. Gary McGraw, Chief Technology Officer of Cigital Incorporated, is a security luminary with several books to his credit, including Software Security, Building Security In, Java Security, and Exploiting Software. His latest book explores the threat to web-based gaming and is called Exploiting Online Games. In this Newsmaker podcast, he talks about why IT professionals should be concerned about exploits against online games, why rootkits will continue to be a major security headache, and how software developers are doing with their code writing. Gary, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks, Bill.
Gary, your upcoming book, Exploiting Online Games, is about games like World of Warcraft and EverQuest. How did you pick online games as the subject?
So the book is really about MMORPGs, which stands for Massive Multiplayer Online Role-Playing Games. You can think of these as sort of Dungeons and Dragons over the internet. The reason that we picked these games is because Greg Hoglund, who I wrote the book with, and I feel like the games are demonstrating today what tomorrow's software security problems are going to be like. Let me explain that a little more fully. If, believe it or not, about 8 million people subscribe to World of Warcraft. That's one of these games. Mm-hmm. There are maybe 12 million people that play these games. And at any one time, about 500,000 people are playing the games together, asynchronously, you know, over a set of servers. And so you have all sorts of interesting issues with time and state. You know, you can't have a big enough computer or a fast enough internet access for 500,000 people to work on one server in real time. So what happens is the server will slice off a little chunk of state, throw it over to the client side piece of the game on somebody's PC, and then they play on that piece, and then they send state information back to the server, but not in real time. And that means that interesting issues about time and state arise. And as you can imagine, these lead to all sorts of bugs and make these kind of games exploitable.
Now, speak to my target audience, which are your IT security people and your software people.
Uh-huh.
Talk about why they should care about online gaming security and why this isn't limited to just, you know, the folks who sit in their bedrooms and play this on the
have
computer.
Have these weird lives. Yeah, I mean, the most interesting thing is that you can actually monetize your cheating if you play online games. In fact, you can monetize your normal play. So you get these characters, and then you progress them through levels, and you get stuff like Vorpal Swords of Heinosity and Pretend Gold, and you can actually sell those items, those bit patterns, for real U.S. dollars. So there's an exchange rate between pretend money and pretend stuff and real money. And as a result, there's quite a huge underground economy that's grown up around some of these games, and some economists claim that the per capita gross domestic product of these games is bigger than some real countries, which is very interesting. Now, IT people need to be worried about what their users are doing. And if your users are spending all their time all day playing these games because they can monetize them, that's bad. So that's sort of an obvious thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another thing that's even more important for IT administrators to think about. Often when you install these games, let's say you're going to let your users play these games on their PCs off hours, or maybe it's a laptop and so they use it at home on the weekends or whatever. These games actually install monitoring software, usually deep in the kernel, that keeps track of what is going on that PC. And so what happens is, the monitoring software reports back all sorts of information about what that user is doing that may have nothing at all to do with the game itself. One example of this is World of Warcraft, who has a process called the Warden that keeps an eye on your PC. Now, some people may claim that this is an invasion of privacy, and
right.
You know, Greg Hoglund's done a lot to hype up that issue. He also wrote a program called The Governor that we put in the book that will allow you to watch The Watcher. But from an IT perspective, what's happening is your user is changing the PC so that programs that do these nefarious kind of spyware-like activities are going to be installed on the box. And the user may not even be aware that they're installed on the box. That's really a headache for IT guys.
This is a nice segue into another area that you focused on quite a bit, which is the danger of rootkits. I hear some of this, and some of it sounds rootkit-like to me.
Yeah, that's right.
Talk a bit about your particular concerns when it comes to rootkit technology and how, you know, the latest technology with things like online gaming or other programs really makes this a growing problem in your mind.
So the problem really came to light, I think, lately when Sony decided to put some rootkit technology on one of their music CDs. Mm-hmm. In fact, they released about 400 CDs that had this rootkit.
Their digital rights management program there?
It was a DRM mm-hmm. Enforcement program, but actually what it was a rootkit. And what it would do is when you put this CD in your PC, it would install a rootkit down in the kernel that would then disallow that PC from doing certain things like, you know, ripping a CD so that you couldn't do something like copy Neil Diamond's latest release. And in fact, you know, some people think that this is punishment for buying a Neil Diamond CD, which seems fair. But nevertheless, the problem once again for IT administrators is, you know, you have a user who's just trying to listen to their headphones with their PC while they're doing some legitimate work, and all of a sudden they've been rooted by this rootkit. And the rootkit was set up in such a way that you could take advantage of its stealth capabilities to hide other processes that may have nothing to do with listening to music.
So we've heard a lot lately about these added security muscle built into Windows Vista.
Yeah.
Do you think that this added security muscle is going to be of any help against this problem?
You know, in the beginning, I had a lot of hopes for that, and I was thinking that Vista would help a lot. But do you remember when Symantec and McAfee were raising Cain because they were mad that they couldn't shim the kernel anymore and that Microsoft was forcing them to use certain APIs and all this other stuff?
The whole patch guard debate.
The whole patch guard thing. Well, what happened was Microsoft was pressured to give some ground. And unfortunately, the ground that they gave, though it might be helpful for Symantec and McAfee, it's also equally helpful for those people who build things like kernel-level rootkits. And so I think that what might have been a really nicely buttoned-down kernel has been opened up, and so we should fully expect to see, you know, rootkit technology for Vista that looks very similar to old rootkit technology. That's one thing. And then on the other front, actually, rootkits have evolved a ton over the years. If you think about it, in the early days, really what people did when they wanted to install a backdoor was they would change an executable, say, on a Unix box so that LS had a special version of LS, and if you passed it a give me a shell flag, it would give you a root shell. And those were pretty easy to find with technology like Tripwire. And then what happened was rootkits started moving down into the kernel, and they started getting administrator privileges or root privileges, which is why they're called rootkits. Hogland released a rootkit for NT long, long ago, and rootkit technology has really evolved quite a bit over the last decade. And in fact, the latest generation is pretty impressive in the way that you can install what I would call a little tiny syringe into the kernel and dump information about state that you want to manipulate to a completely different processor, where you carry out the bad activities and then inject it back in the other side. So it's really moved a long way.
Let me ask you this, you know, speaking of companies like Symantec and McAfee that did make a big fuss about PatchGuard, do you think that they had a legitimate gripe and that they were entitled to some of what Microsoft did for them and that maybe Microsoft just took it too far? Or do you think that Microsoft should have just said, hey, this is the way it needs to be. Figure out your own, figure out your own solution on your end.
It's very, very tricky. It's a complicated situation. I think that McAfee and Symantec had a legitimate right to whine, because it's very clear and obvious that Microsoft is moving into their business and muscling them out. And Microsoft could, in fact, leverage the fact that they own the operating system to outcompete the other security vendors. So that's a real concern. And, of course, the EU is involved looking into the whole thing, and that put a ton of pressure on Microsoft. So that's one aspect of it. And then the other aspect is, okay, well, let's forget about monopolies and competition and all that stuff and just think about it with our technology hat on alone. From a technology perspective, unfortunately, Microsoft was forced to do the wrong thing. So you have, a complex situation where the business situation came out kind of right, but it set us back on the technology side. And that's the way things go all the time in this complicated field of ours.
Sure. Now, switching gears, you've been a leading voice on the need for software makers like Microsoft and others to do a better job at building security into their code. And you've written three books on the subject. I'll list them: Building Secure Software, Exploiting Software, and Software Security, Building Security In, which came out last year. What's the state of the union, so to speak, on how companies are doing?
I'm pretty optimistic about the progress we've made in software security. You know, back when I wrote Building Secure Software with John Viega, who's now the chief scientist of McAfee, by the way, we could not convince even our own mothers that software security was important. We sort of, we would say software, and everybody would go, yeah, 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 and we go security, and everybody would go, yeah, 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 and we'd say software security, and they would look at us and go, huh, what are you talking about? Well, that's changed a ton. Now, everybody understands the software security problem. I think we've made a huge amount of progress on the evangelism front. And where we sit now is there are a bunch of people who say, all right, I get it. I need to do software security. What am I supposed to do? And that's where we're sitting now in the state of the practice. My book, Software Security, is, in fact, about all those sorts of things that you should do to put security into your software development lifecycle. So things like code review with a static analysis tool, architectural risk analysis, abuse case development, penetration testing, software security testing, those sorts of things, and monitoring at the operations level. So we've moved from just worrying about the problem and whining about the problem to starting to develop and put in place best practices. Now, there are some vendors who've done quite a bit to really bootstrap software security programs from nothing. The one who everybody knows about, of course, is Microsoft with their Trustworthy Computing Initiative, and they've made lots of great progress under the leadership of Mike Howard and Steve Lipner. I'm happy that they're doing what they're doing. They got a long way to go, but boy, have they made some good progress. And then, the banks in New York are all doing a lot of work in software security. There's some cell phone vendors who have done a lot of work in software security. People are doing things like training all of their developers, and we're talking tens of thousands of developers, to understand that software security is a problem that they need to work on. People are doing a lot to buy the right kinds of tools and instantiate them at the sort of edge of the stuff going on with static analysis tools. There are companies like Fidelity who are building their own special purpose rules to enforce and then causing everybody to use these tools. We've been deeply involved in that sort of activity. And then on the architectural risk analysis front, I think that people have begun to adopt methods like Stride or methods like Sigital's architectural risk analysis process to begin to look for problems at the architectural level. Mm-hmm. So we've made a lot of progress. It's been fun. Sigital's software security group is just about a decade old. We started it in 1997. So soon we're going to have our 10th birthday. And I think that what you see is the rise of software security groups all over the place, in vendors, in banks. There are some consultancies working on this stuff. And I'm very optimistic that we're moving the ball down the field in the right direction.
And we'll be back after this message.
As an information security professional, You've no doubt heard of Nmap, the popular freeware tool. It can be a huge help in the enterprise when searching for available hosts and services or pinpointing open ports. However, installing, configuring, and running Nmap in the enterprise is no easy task. With that in mind, SearchSecurity.com has teamed up with security expert Michael Cobb to create an Nmap technical guide. This guide details exactly how you can use Nmap to make your organization more secure. This guide is available for free at SearchSecurity.com/Nmap. Again, that's SearchSecurity.com/Nmap. Check it out today.
And we're back with Gary McGraw.
Hi, Bill.
So, Gary, based on your last comment about the state of security in the code writing process, would you say that you think the good guys are winning the cyber war overall, or what's your assessment there?
I think the arms race continues in a very interesting fashion, and I do want to point out one thing. Software security is much more intense than just worrying about code writing. We can't just think about bugs like stir copy problems or getS in C and C++. There's some vendors, especially application security vendors, who would like you to believe that if you just got the code right, everything would be hunky-dory. But about half of the problems that we see in software security have to do with design and architectural level things. I'll give you an obvious example. Forgot to authenticate user at all. That's an architectural problem. Mm-hmm. So we have to focus some attention on that as well. Now, with regard to what's going on in the cyber war, it's very clear that progress has been made on both sides. One of the reasons that I think it's important to write books like Exploiting Software and Exploiting Online Games is that we talk about real attacks with real code and real examples, and we sort of cut through the vendor baloney and show people the sophisticated attacker view of how software looks when you do things like wield a decompiler at it. And it's important that we understand what we're up against from a bad guy perspective. So I think the bad guys have done a lot to keep up with what we're doing on the security front, and that it'll always be that way. You know, that's why on the front of software security you see the yin-yang with a black hat and a white hat. I think that we're always going to have a mix of describing and studying attacks and building better offense stuff.
The never-ending battle between good and evil.
The never-ending battle between good and evil, both being necessary, you know. And so I sort of take that holistic approach to the problem, and I think we're stuck with that.
So, Gary, we're going to close up now with a fun little feature we like to do with these newsmaker interviews called the Rapid Fire Q&A.
All right.
These are five questions, and not all of them are related to security. And I'm going to ask that you keep your answers as brief as possible.
Okay, here we go.
Here we go. When you're not working, what's your favorite guilty pleasure?
Music. I have a band, and I love to play music, and it's a huge part of my life.
What's your all-time favorite band and album?
Geez, that's just impossible. But I think my all-time favorite band probably has to be Pink Floyd, just because I was indoctrinated. I don't have a favorite album in particular, though.
What's your favorite TV show?
Don't watch TV.
None?
Not at all.
None whatsoever?
None.
Wow.
I use my TV as a video device for the Wii and as a DVD display device. And I do have internet TV as a side effect of my internet service. Sorry, I mean satellite TV as a side effect of my internet service at home.
Ah. What book would you recommend that all InfoSec pros read?
Oh, that's an easy one. Ross Anderson's book, Security Engineering. Best security book ever written.
What is your advice, your number one advice for people entering the InfoSecurity business?
Don't be bamboozled into believing that if you just learn a simple checklist of things and get your CISSP, that's what security is all about.
Gary McGraw, CTO of Sigital. Thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. That's fun, Bill.
This concludes our special SearchSecurity.com Newsmaker podcast, where we feature in-depth interviews with thought leaders in the information security market. A reminder that the latest information security news is always available as it breaks on our news page at searchsecurity.com/news. And you can always catch our Security Wire weekly podcasts featuring summaries of the latest news and interviews with security professionals at searchsecurity.com/podcast. Again, I'm Bill Brenner. Thanks for listening.